The time is now. Volume 8, Episode 141, This is Employment Law Now. I am Mike Schmidt, your host of the podcast and the Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department here at Cozen O'Connor. I just finished, as you know from my last episodes, saying Happy New Year to everybody, and yet here we are on March 1st. It's crazy. Every year I feel like I'm saying more often how fast the year goes, how fast the weeks and months go, but each year it feels like it goes faster than the prior one. I hope all of you are doing well. I've got a great guest today. Not the first time that she's been on the podcast, but I am so appreciative of how many appearances she has been willing to make and give so graciously of her time. EEOC Commissioner Andrea Lucas was confirmed by the Senate in 2020 to be one of the five EEOC commissioners, and her term currently expires next year in July of 2025. Those of you who have heard her here and in other contexts know that Commissioner Lucas is passionate about the EEOC's work and mission, and she's particularly passionate about making sure that organizations provide equal opportunity for everybody, and passionate about what that means in the context of DEI initiatives. There's been a lot of talk about that over the past 8 months, particularly since the Supreme Court came out with its last decision last June. And I wanted to have EEOC Commissioner Lucas come back onto the podcast to talk a little bit about what that case meant for Title VII and the laws that the EEOC actually enforces. And what are some of the best practices that employers should implement and should be thinking about when deciding whether to create DEI initiatives or when reviewing existing DEI initiatives? Here's my interview with Commissioner Lucas. Commissioner Lucas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
No, it's so great to have you come on to the podcast, and appreciate all of the repeat performances, so thank you. I want to table set very quickly. As most of all of you out there listening know by now, the Supreme Court issued a long-awaited decision back on June 29th, 2023, in the case of Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and University of North Carolina. As you all know and remember, the court ruled that race-conscious admission policies at both universities were unconstitutional, notwithstanding the apparent salutary intent of addressing diverse student bodies. Notably, that case had nothing to do with employment law, as we all talk about, yet since June, there has been much discussion and much substantial debate over what employers can and can't do with regard to DEI initiatives. So let me start there, Commissioner. What did the Supreme Court actually say, and did it change anything in terms of the EEO laws that are enforced by your commission, the EEOC?
Well, thanks again for having me. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, as always, just before we get started, I just want to note that as one commissioner on a five-person panel, I'm speaking on my own behalf today, except for I refer to commission policy guidance and other documents and information published by the commission. That said, there's some really subtle points of law and official agency positions that we're going to talk about today that have some important consequences for DEI. So turning back to SSFA, in my opinion, the takeaway is that the Supreme Court brought university admissions case law into closer parallel with the longstanding, more restrictive standards of federal employment law. As most listeners probably know, the Civil Rights Act has two different Title 6 for education and Title 7 for employment. And while these statutory sections are similar, they're still distinct, and the court had historically interpreted their requirements differently. Prior to the SSFA ruling, the court permitted universities to use race as one factor in higher education admissions based on an interest in promoting diversity. Explicitly, the factor was diversity. And so SSFA in June overruled previous cases and barred race decision-making or affirmative action in higher education admissions. In employment, though, and under Title VII, the separate title for the employment context, it's been the rule for decades that employers generally were not permitted to take employment actions motivated in whole or in part by protected characteristics such as race. There's some rare exceptions to this rule which remain unchanged. So, you know, the short answer is SSFA has no direct immediate legal impact on the existing standards in the employment context under Title VII. But as you know, the fallout of this practically has been significant.
Absolutely. And I'm going to get into Title VII and sort of your wheelhouse in a moment. From that decision, obviously, there have been a lot of people who have come out on this issue. You and your colleagues on the commission certainly have authored opinions in various outlets. The attorneys general from at least 13 states have sent letters to multiple Fortune 100 companies to remind them of their obligations under the law. What's the main point that you're trying to get across coming out of the Supreme Court's decision, if I asked you to make an elevator pitch?
Well, I don't know if this is an elevator pitch, but I'll keep it to 3 points, and I promise they're relatively short. So nutshell, first, the Supreme Court's decision last June doesn't squarely change existing legal risks from certain corporate diversity programs, but it absolutely heightens the practical risk. Second, in my perspective, a number of popular corporate diversity programs, primarily equity-focused ones, already pose legal risks under the existing and continuing employment law standards. Now, even though the Supreme Court's decision was in the education context, that decision put a broad spotlight on the use of race-conscious programs in multiple contexts, including in employment. And then third, the takeaway for both of those two first points is that companies need to do a careful audit of any DEI or ESG employment-related policies to ensure that their companies neither has policies that facially discriminate nor policies that would incentivize managers to discriminate.
Absolutely. That is very helpful. And so I want to focus a little bit more on Title VII. As you said a moment ago, and as we've acknowledged, the Supreme Court's decision is in the educational context, not so much when it comes to Title VII or private employment, but it has provided a spotlight on this issue, perhaps more than it has in years before the June decision. So what is the current state of the law from a Title VII standpoint on when employers can and cannot have DEI or affirmative action programs?
So I'll start with something that sounds a little bit like a truism, but matters. So first, because SFA didn't directly change the law in the employment context, diversity, equity, inclusion, and other employment policies that were legal before SSFA likely remain legal, and illegal ones remain illegal. All of my colleagues and I are largely in agreement on that point. Now, whether that's reassuring or cause for concern is where I think some of my colleagues and I differ, and whether the state of the law post-SFA is good or bad news for any particular employer depends on whether or not that employer was already complying with the pre-existing and continuing restrictive standards that apply to the use of race, sex, and other protected characteristics. And we'll talk about the view of the law on that, but one last preliminary point, and that's important to acknowledge that DEI is a really broad umbrella term that many employment stakeholders are using, and companies sometimes label a bunch of different efforts as being DEI, but it's not really helpful to talk in generalities because not every employment policy that's labeled as DEI is automatically unlawful, and likewise, not every DEI policy is lawful. So it's really going to depend on the functional reality. Same thing is true for whether or not a DEI program is DEI or voluntary affirmative action. It's going to depend on the structure and the operation of any particular program. That being said, you know, even if specific facts are always key, as a general matter, there's some high-level principles of law that always apply, and there are some higher-risk categories of DEI policies and programs following from those 5 points that I'll cover now. So, you know, what are the 5 ways I think every employer should know? And I also emphasize, again, these are drawn from Black These are drawn from black letter Title VII law and longstanding EEOC official positions. This isn't just my opinion. These are generally non-controversial points, but they do have really significant implications for DEI. So what's the key points? Point one, there's no such thing as reverse race or sex discrimination under our civil rights laws. There's just discrimination. Different treatment based on race or sex is discrimination, no matter which group of employees is harmed or benefits. That's a longstanding position of the EEOC, the longstanding position of the Supreme Court. There's no restriction to just historically underrepresented employees. The civil rights laws apply to everyone. Point two, in general, the bright line rule is that employers are not permitted to take any employment actions motivated by race or sex. That also has been the rule for decades in employment law. So unlike the old rules in the university admissions area, in employment law, race or sex can't be a plus factor, tiebreaker, tipping point. That's not permitted. Point three, Title VII applies to a really broad range of individuals. So it's not just current employees, it's job applicants, interns, applicants for training programs. People sometimes really only myopically focus on just employees and think that pre-full-time employment programs aren't going to be covered. That's not the case. Four, the rules against employers acting based on race or sex applies to more than just hiring, firing, compensation decisions, or other tangible or material or quote-unquote employment, ultimate employment decisions. That's a timely issue because the Supreme Court in Muldrow is addressing that issue. But the current state of the law in terms of the agency's position and a vast number of appellate courts is that, so EEOC, DOJ, across multiple administrations, and at this point, 50% of the federal appellate courts take the position that Title VII bars discriminations in all actions affecting terms, conditions, and privileges of employment, including actions that fall short of hiring, firing, and compensation. In my opinion, the takeaway of that is that Title VII is going to extend to things like training programs and leadership development programs, mentoring, sponsorship programs, even selecting applicants for interviews or placing them on a candidate slate. And then the final point is just the exception to the rule. Employers can consider race and sex in only very limited circumstances if it's a part of a voluntary remedial affirmative action plan. That's a really narrow exception, though. And in the existence of an affirmative action plan is direct evidence of unlawful discrimination unless the plan is valid. So if you're going to adopt that plan, you need to get it right. If you're going to adopt a diversity program that's functioning like that, you need to get it right. The label's not going to matter. It's going to matter about whether or not it's actually operating like one. And by operating one, is it taking race or sex into consideration explicitly, or is it driving towards achieving a desired racial balance, for example? So the fairly strict standards around that exception, you can never use quotas, you can't use inflexible goals to get to that, and you've got to make sure you're using the right comparator. If in a voluntary affirmative action plan, you're saying, okay, well, I have an underrepresentation, you can't just sort of vaguely wave around this concept of underrepresentation. It's not good enough to talk about societal underrepresentation or historical inequities. You need to show something tailored to your particular company, your job market, and you need to measure against your particular labor market, not the general U.S. population, your local community, your customer base, which is something I see a lot of companies trending towards, and that's just not sufficient justification for one of these exceptions to the general rule against race or sex conscious action.
So you're saying it's not enough, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but it's not enough to just say we want to sort of right the wrong of how we perceive society, or we just want to promote general diversity and think that we have not done a good enough job doing that. You're saying that neither of those would be sufficient to meet the strict standards under Title VII law.
That's right. And so, you know, a lot of companies will use the term historically underrepresented minority groups or historically underrepresented populations. So by that, they're referring to broadly across the board in our nation's history, their perception that particular groups may fall into that definition. it might match up with their company or their job position. It might not. Their company may have only been around for a short period of time. They may actually have representation depending on their labor market or a fairly healthy applicant pool. You can't refer to a broader set of societal problems and assume that that's automatically going to be enough to show that you get to take race-motivated action in your company's particular situation for that particular job position too.
And one of the things that you touched on in your 5 points just a moment ago, and I wanted to touch on one of them, a lot of people talk about this issue when they think that it just really applies with the recruitment process and hiring. But this isn't just about recruitment, is it? We're also talking about internal promotions and other DEI initiatives that a company may have.
That's right. That's a really big oversight that I see a lot of employers having. DEI initiatives can be found at every stage of the employment life cycle, as anyone in HR or EEO knows these days. And likewise, Title VII covers a really broad swath of employment actions, policies, programs. It's a major blind side if you're not spot for an employer, if you're not scrutinizing programs that are falling outside of recruitment, hiring, firing, and compensation, based on some sort of misimpression that DEI programs aren't going to involve an adverse action. So it's okay. The rules don't apply here. That's not the case.
Okay. And so you've said at the start of this that you're one of five commissioners at the commission. You also said when you were giving the 5 points that in your view, you didn't think that they were all that controversial. Without speaking for your colleagues, of course, are there differences in views with the other commissioners at the EEOC about DE&I, particularly post the Supreme Court's June decision?
So as I've already noticed, there isn't much room for disagreement in terms of the state of the law and the key principles that apply here. I think my colleagues and I are all largely on the same page regarding the state of the law. I also think there's a fair amount of consensus about how to assess risk for various categories of DEI policies across party lines on the commission. But we certainly have different perspectives about how employers should think about the current state of affairs, whether or not there's cause for optimism and encouragement, or skepticism and cause for concern. And the other thing I'll say is, I've had many thoughtful discussions with my colleagues on the DEI issue, but I think that, respectively, many of the defenses of DEI programs in the wake of the SSFA decision, including from my colleagues, but also from Democrat AGs, other proponents of DEI, they're all really focused on what I view as a straw man of race neutral initiatives and a red herring of something that's really more an EEO type policy that's being recast or labeled as DEI. And in my opinion and experience, neither DEI proponents or DEI critics, in terms of what they're really worried about, really focused on, is they're not really focused on race-neutral diversity policies and practices. They're focused on whether or not it's lawful to have explicitly race-conscious, race-limited, equity-focused policies and programs. So if you're not talking about that, you're sidestepping the issues that I'm focused on. And, what are my colleagues and others defending on? They're defending things like knocking out barriers to full participation or reducing barriers in equal opportunity or programs that are implemented in race-neutral ways or programs that are broadly inclusive or involve expanding outreach and recruitment efforts or conducting robust EEO analyses. Those are all great, but those defenses shouldn't give much assurance to companies who are or want to use more aggressive DEI measures. And I've said this in other contexts. I do think it's important to repeat. I mean, there's a very simple reason why my colleagues and the Democrat AGs and other DEI proponents are not specifically defending race-conscious, race-limited, race-motivated policies, programs, and decision-makings, and that because that type of DEI is generally indefensible. So if your DEI program contains those elements, you either need to cut them out or you need to be prepared to defend them as a voluntary affirmative action program under Weber and Johnson. And the latter path is a very steep hill to climb.
And so we talk about, your position, and you've been vocal about your position on this issue. It's an important issue, certainly for you. We've heard on this podcast, but also in other settings, Commissioner Samuels and others talk about this. Given the majority of the EEOC, has there been a public sort of statement or public-facing statement, whether you know, through a setting like this, through enforcement, through litigation post the Supreme Court decision, on how the EEOC as a body is going to be looking at this issue?
Not to date. I will say that we still have our race discrimination guidance document. That's official EEOC policy out there. And it covers many of the points that I just covered, which, you know, remains good law, so to speak. We don't make law, but, you know, it's good EEOC policy. It's active policy. And you know, it covers a host of these, you know, basic principles that have implications for DEI.
Do we know, and maybe the answer is you can't say yet, but do we know whether there's going to be an update to that given the current situation?
I don't have anything I can offer at this time. But, you know, I'd be surprised if there was, because the law hasn't changed. These are principles that have been around for decades. And if anything, to the extent that the law has changed, it's made it much less likely that the Supreme Court in the future might go in a more diversity friendly direction. You know, I think part of the reason why a lot of companies borrowed from the education space was there was hope by some that, you know, diversity as a plus factor or soft factor or motivation in employment, in education, would bleed over into employment. And that would be the direction the court would go. With, you know, the SSFA decision, I think that that's pretty squarely foreclosed. So I, you know, I think it's much more likely now, and it is the case now, that the restrictive standards of employment law have instead gone over towards education law, and they're going to stay restrictive. They're not going to loosen in terms of the use of race decision making. So I don't really know what we would be able to do that would be lawful to lean it into that in a different direction than what the Supreme Court's already done.
So if there's no controversy yet there, let's look for some controversy somewhere, because who doesn't love some good social media controversy? It is not surprising when we oftentimes see sports, for example, mixed with pop culture, such as, and you know, who's not either loving or tired of the Kansas City Chiefs and Taylor Swift stuff. But many of us out there on social media were surprised to see some interaction between sports and employment law earlier this calendar year, specifically with you, Commissioner. For those who may have missed it, you had a rather highly publicized exchange with Mark Cuban. Some know him as the owner of the NBA's Dallas Mavericks, some as host of Shark Tank, and I guess some know him just as a billionaire investor who is vocal on social media on a number of issues. For purposes of today's discussion, Mark Cuban was engaging in a discussion on X, which was formerly Twitter, as we all know, where he said the following, and I want to read specifically from his tweet. He wrote, "I've never hired anyone based exclusively on race, gender, religion. I only ever hire the person that will put my business in the best position to succeed." Then he went on to say in the next sentence, "And yes, race and gender can be part of the equation. I view diversity as a competitive advantage." His tweet went on a little bit, but I want to stop there because that tweet obviously caught your eye on social media. And at the sake of oversimplifying your response, you told Mark Cuban that he was, quote, dead wrong, end quote. Why was he dead wrong in what he said?
So I'll read my response in a little bit fuller, but yeah, the takeaway is he was dead wrong. So what I said was, you know, unfortunately, you're dead wrong on black letter Title VII law. As a general rule, race, sex can't be a motivating factor, nor a plus factor, tiebreaker, or tipping point. It's important for employers to understand the ground rules here. And, you know, the last sentence in that tweet is the heart of what I was concerned about. It's really important when you have a really publicized conversation. You know, his tweet had gotten 5 million views. My response, I think, got almost 3 million. But, you know, I think it's important for us to not mislead the public, and to, if we see a really public misconception trending quite a bit, to try to clarify the law where we can in any forum. All the commissioners tweet, you know, we use LinkedIn, we use all sorts of sources, we speak at conferences. It's part of our, you know, our education role in this job. And his tweet, I thought, kind of perfectly illustrated two common misunderstandings around employment decisions. So the first one is that race or sex could be, quote unquote, part of the equation for an employment decision, as long as that isn't the sole factor or the deciding factor. As I said, that's dead wrong. If race or sex was all or even part of an employer's motivation, that violates federal employment law. And then the second common misunderstanding that I think kind of underlies his viewpoint there, even if it's a little less explicit, is the belief that some types of race-based or sex-based employment decisions are lawful and good, provided they benefit certain racial minority groups or benefit women, or that they promote some general interests in diversity or equity. That's unfortunately also wrong. No matter how benevolent a motive that it's cast, or your interest is in promoting diversity or righting societal wrongs, there's no good race or sex discrimination. So if you're doing disparate treatment based on diversity motivation, that's still unlawful discrimination.
And so I'm glad you read your response tweet, because when you said, as a general rule, race, sex can't even be a motivating factor, nor a plus factor, tiebreaker, or tipping point. I try to stay away from getting into the legal ease weeds on this podcast, because, I'm afraid people are going to start falling asleep or turning this off. But I do want to focus on that for a second for those people who are interested in the nuance here. We've got some statutes that deal with a but-for standard, and we've got some statutes that deal with a motivating factor standard. So why were you emphasizing the motivating factor point here, and why would that be different if it were a but-for standard? What's the difference between the two?
Sure. So this is a little wonky, but its causation standards are important to get right. I'll just explain this in a little bit. I mean, even under but-for causation, I think he had some problems in his understanding. That would be so in the weeds that I don't think would be great for a popular audience. But I know you have an educated audience, so I indulge me in explaining this a little bit. So everyone knows but-for and motivating factor are two alternate theories. They apply to Title VII. And they're trying to tease out what it means to say because of. So if race was the or a but for cause of employment of an employment decision, that means the but for that person's race, the employer wasn't going to make the decision it made. So if you choose to hire or not hire someone because they're a specific race, and that particular outcome would not have happened if they were a different race, and that person was a race was a but for cause of your decision, you violated Title VII if so. And the same thing goes for sex. If it's dispositive of the decision, you've established but for cause. Now, what I didn't explain in my tweet, but I think is important to note here after the Bostock decision, is that employers do make decisions based on a variety of characteristics, a host of stuff, qualifications, experience, work ethic, etc. Even under but for causation, as Justice Gorsuch notes in Bostock, quote, a defendant cannot avoid liability just by citing some other factor that contributed to its challenged employment decision, end quote. So as long as the protected characteristic was, quote, but one but-for cause of that decision, that's enough to trigger the law, end quote. So you can have multiple but-for causes. And then turning to motivating factor, which is what I, focused on, a little easier to explain to the popular audience, that causation standard is even broader. It means that if you violated the law, if a protected characteristic motivated your decision, even if other factors also motivated the decision, and even if the protected characteristic wasn't the dispositive factor. So clearly that's imposing a higher burden on employers. So either way, if race and sex are part of the equation, which is how he frames it, you've definitely incurred liability under motivating factor causation, and you might have problems under the stricter but-for causation standard too. The fact that race and sex aren't, as he phrases it, the quote-unquote exclusive reason for a decision isn't going to be enough to avoid liability. As mentioned, under Title VII, there could be multiple but-for causes. So if your race or sex was even one of multiple dispositive factors, that's enough to show but-for cause too.
And so the issue that you took was when he tweeted, yes, race and gender can be part of the equation. From your standpoint, part of the equation suggests that it was a motivating factor, even if there were other factors that motivated the decision, in which case it would still be violating Title VII. That was your point.
Yeah, that was my point. And, you know, he seemed to focus on, as long as I didn't hire anyone exclusively on race, like, that's the only reason I did that. Now, he might mean, well, I considered a variety of things, or he may have meant that, you know, well, that wasn't the dispositive reason. Either way, you have problems, whether you're going under but-for cause or motivating factor. If it's in the mix, it was actually part of your motive. At a bare minimum, you have motivating factor. And if it was dispositive, even if it wasn't the exclusive reason, you also could have but-for causation.
And, you know, I think it's also interesting or important to step back and note as follows. We're not having this discussion as sort of a policy debate or a policy discussion. We're not really talking about what you think is the right thing to be doing or how you feel about, you know, the virtues, the pros and cons of DEI programs. What we're talking about is certainly your view, but your view on what Title VII says. I mean, and I guess it'd be a different discussion if Congress decides to amend Title VII in one way or the other. But we're not really having a debate, I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, on how you view the virtues or the negatives of DEI programs.
That's right. You know, in that tweet, my goal is just to educate the public about the state of the law, not to, you know, discuss the merits of any particular policy outcome. And, you know, you've got to start with complying with the law. That's the fundamental. Once you know what the law is, you can decide what you might want to do within a suite of options. You know, I certainly have my own opinions about policy, but, you know, what we're focusing on for the bulk of this conversation really is just about what's the state of the law. And it's pretty clear. A lot of people hadn't spent enough time focusing on it, or perhaps decided that some policy interests overrode the law, but that doesn't change what the law actually is.
And so, you know, we spent a good amount of time here talking about, in terms of applying the law, what you can't do with your DEI initiatives and policies. But when you said earlier in this episode that companies need to get it right, that suggests that there are things that can be done from a DEI perspective. So I want to go to that and ask you, you know, are there things that employers can lawfully do to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion principles?
That's a good question. So the really short answer is, as long as your employment programs, no matter what you call them, are truly race and gender neutral, and they're focused on reducing barriers and promoting equal opportunity, they should be low risk under Title VII. And programs to avoid are ones that are going to specifically involve race or sex decision making, and those that strongly incentivize it, particularly through financial means. And I do have a long list of things I recommend employers do, 11 points to be exact, if you'll indulge
me in
that.
Sure.
But, you know, I do want to push a little bit on what employers mean by promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion principles. And this is a policy consideration point. I'll distinguish that from the state of the law. Okay. You know, DEI has come with a lot of baggage increasingly in popular discussion. And, you know, in some contexts, DEI can encompass more of a particular ideology or worldview than you might expect from the individual component words of diversity or inclusion. So as a policy matter, I would encourage employers to return in general to a focus of promoting equal employment opportunity, eliminating discrimination, and improving business operations and management of employees to promote merit and excellence. Now, doing each of those things often is going to have an outsized positive impact on certain historically underrepresented groups society-wide. But the shift in motive can make a big difference in the legality of your efforts. And I think it's the right thing to do as a policy matter as well. So that's the lens where I'm coming from in terms of the specific suggestions I have. However you label them, I think these are a good idea. And I think they're all lawful. And I think that they may achieve some of the similar ends that many employers are looking for. You know, but I view them as framed around promoting equal employment opportunity, eliminating discrimination, and promoting merit and excellence. Different people may characterize them or label them in different ways. So here's my list of 11 things. I got content.
All right, give everyone a second to get pen to paper.
Go ahead. So point one, you should audit all your job descriptions to remove unnecessary job requirements. And in particular, I'd recommend removing unnecessary degree requirements. Two, I'd audit your job descriptions, job ads, and interview questions for race and sex preferences. Three, I'd standardize interview questions for similar jobs. Eliminate unnecessary interview questions targeted at fit, especially if fit is code for like current employees or a protected characteristic. The more subjective your interview process is, the more easy it is to have bias. And bias isn't good for anyone. It doesn't promote merit. It certainly can lead towards discrimination. Four, standardized promotion and internal hiring processes. You could consider removing tap on the shoulder informal processes and post all internal jobs. And relatedly, consider moving from an opt-in method for promotion and internal job opportunities, instead using opt-out methods. So, you know, everyone of a certain level is automatically considered for a promotion. They're welcome to opt out if they want to, but you don't have to ask them to raise their hand. Five, if you're concerned about unequal access to mentoring and sponsorship, lots of companies are doing that when they're instituting a DEI, a mentoring or sponsorship program. My recommendation is don't try to fix an old boy club just by replacing it or adding to it another exclusive club limited by race or sex, just a different race or sex. Instead, offer a standardized mentoring or sponsorship program to all employees or all employees in certain positions without any race or sex restrictions. And if you had a previously DEI mentoring or sponsorship program that you're now reconsidering and deciding to make it more inclusive or broadly open to all comers, make sure employees really understand that you mean it. It truly is for all comers. You're not just relabeling it. Six, you should offer standardized leadership development training for all employees at a particular level. Again, no opt-ins, no race, sex restrictions. Seven, if your interest in DEI was motivated by a desire to promote social mobility, that's another thing that I hear. It's a common theme around DEI programs. Consider programs instead directed towards first-generation professionals. So that could be offering additional training in your company for all first-generation professionals or first-generation college grads, no race or sex restriction, or offering an employee resource group or a mentoring program for first-gen employees, or even offering first-gen internships. Again, make sure that that's race and sex neutral. But it can often lead towards your goal of social mobility, but it's going to float all boats, and it will be vastly more legal than the one that's race or sex restricted. Eight, if you think a specific employee needs additional training, of course, you can always offer training based on an individualized assessment of that particular employee's skills, abilities, and performance. Just don't do it based on a racial stereotype or a sex stereotype. Nine, conduct a privileged audit to identify portions of your business that might have issues with existing discrimination or harassment against women or racial and ethnic minorities. Clean up that discrimination or harassment. You should be doing that. You must be doing that. That's going to get at maybe some actual problems you have in your specific workplace, as opposed to trying to take a broader societal problem and assuming it's going to apply evenly in your particular workplace. 10, we're nearing the end here. Aim for equal opportunity by widening the pool of potential applicants. So that can happen in a lot of different ways. So for entry-level post-college hiring, widen the pool of colleges from which you recruit or hire. Advertise for jobs in a wide array of forms and formats. Not everyone's going to be literate, and you may not need the same level of literacy for a particular job. Some people prefer radio or a paper job application as opposed to electronic. Not everyone's going to have equal access to electronic forums. Multiple languages, different forms catering to a variety of audiences. That's all great to widen in a pool. And if you want to remove or lower a job requirement to remove your, to widen your pool of applicants, for example, you want to lower a GPA cutoff, that's fine, but make sure you remove or lower that requirement for all applicants. Don't just lower it for applicants of a particular race or sex. And then my final one is a big picture point. Point 11, rethink work culture, especially in leadership and executive roles that's focused on overwork. This kind of work culture likely will have a disproportionately negative impact on women who are caregivers, on first-generation professionals, and other employees from less economically privileged backgrounds who might have more caregiver duties for siblings or grandparents or extended families, and on immigrant employees for similar reasons. But a workaholic work culture that is not good for anyone. It hurts all employees. It's not healthy to be encouraging people to sacrifice balance and personal life. It has a serious impact on retaining and attracting workers. And to the extent that that work culture is most prevalent in your management ranks, it can create a real barrier to promotion mobility from entry level to management level. So again, another one where it may get at some of the similar interests that employers have, but this is the way to do it in a race neutral way that's focused on equal employment opportunity, that's going to equally benefit the opportunity for all employees, and therefore it's going to be safer, and I think as a policy matter is the better course to go at this.
That's very helpful, and I hope people will continue to play this over and over as they are taking their notes and writing all this down to bring back to their organizations. Two questions as a follow-up that I wanted to ask you based on that list. Resource groups. We get asked that quite a bit. Are employers legally permitted as a general matter to maintain resource groups?
Yes, as long as those resource groups are open to all comers and don't prohibit out-of-group members. And you should also be wary of seeming to favor certain ERGs, employment resource groups, over others if and when company resources are made available for ERGs. You don't want to create a bunch of different series of old boys clubs just for different race or sex groups. That can be problematic, but many employees do find it helpful to have sort of a centralized place to voice interests and share interests and talk about their particular perspectives. It's generally a low risk activity as long as you're making sure that they're not race or sex restricted to who wants to participate in them.
And another question that we get all the time as well deals with training. Can employers continue to include DEI in their training materials? And I guess another question is, should they?
Well, the easy answer is, at least when it was, again, what do we mean by DEI? If we're actually just talking about a straightforward EEO training or an anti-discrimination training or anti-harassment, those are all legal. They're a good idea to prevent discrimination and harassment. The EEOC always supports that. Don't worry about those. As for something that's purely DEI, it's not just the realm of EEO or anti-harassment, anti-discrimination training. The can and should they question are definitely different questions. In terms of can they, the legality of these trainings is going to depend on the actual substance of the trainings. So when you're evaluating the legality of a DEI training, you should make sure that neither the design nor the execution of the training contributes to a hostile work environment. That's something that I was concerned about for a long period of time. We are seeing more case law development on that point. The EEOC recently filed an amicus brief acknowledging two cases in which courts have ruled in favor of plaintiffs who present evidence that the design or execution of a diversity training was discriminatory, or at the motion to dismiss stage, plaintiffs who made plausible allegations that explain how a training was discriminatory. So one of those cases is an older case. It's called Hartman v. Pena, in case listeners want to look it up. It involved a cultural diversity workshop that was found to contribute to a hostile work environment against men. And then the modern case, that's actually an ongoing one, and it's definitely a hot case to watch for employers, called DiPiero versus Penn State University in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And the court recently found on a motion to dismiss stage that a professor had plausibly alleged a hostile work environment claim based on diversity trainings that address racial issues and which allegedly consistently and categorically disparaged white people. So it'll be interesting to see how that case shapes out. But either way, the EEOC's position is that you should always assess the legality of any particular training based on the content itself, including in the diversity space. And then in terms of whether or not you should include DEI in training, as a policy matter, I'm skeptical about the effectiveness of some DEI training, even if the training content and execution is lawful. There's been a lot of research and articles lately discussing that some diversity training can actually be counterproductive, either because it reinforces racial stereotypes or by increasing racial animus and resentment in the workplace. So, I just encourage employers to think thoughtfully through that and examine the pros and cons and think about what they're trying to gain from a particular training.
So even though I think some private companies, private employers tend to be spooked by government agency, I do like to think that there's some common interest here. You know, employers want to do the right thing when it comes to promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion principles and do it the right way. And as you've been talking, you know, you and the other commissioners on the EEOC, they want employers to do it the right way if they're going to do it. Have employers or can employers come to you? You talked a little bit about an educational component today. Can employers come to the EEOC to work with the commission on putting a program together? Certainly without fear of any kind of, you know, negative coming back to them through an enforcement proceeding or a charge. But is that something from an educational standpoint where the EEOC might work directly with an employer on putting together this type of program?
I don't know of anything specifically related to that other than, you know, each one of us speak and write on this issue and are always happy to talk to employers and employees at conferences, at events, at various stakeholders, and, you know, offer our thoughts on that. In the voluntary affirmative action program context, we do have regulations. They're very old, but they are out there that you can look at in that space. You know, I'm not aware of anyone pre-floating them other than if they're already dealing with a, you know, conciliation agreement or a settlement agreement. I think that's not necessarily the situation that someone wants to land themselves in. But in that case, we'll, you know, we'll work with you to green light something. Otherwise, I think it's not typical for the agency to green light a specific program, but
yeah, and certainly, you know, asking because we're obviously not dealing with opinion letters, you know, for example, with the EEOC. So if there was something of its equivalent,
well, actually, you know, the EEOC does have opinion letters. They don't happen often, right. But we both have formal and informal letters. So in theory, you can reach out to our office legal counsel and ask for an opinion letter about your particular program. That's something that the commission would vote on. It's a rarer situation.
That's more what I meant, that we don't really see that being used as a vehicle, certainly in this kind of context.
Yeah, not common.
We talked a little bit about, I asked you if we can expect any kind of guidance or any kind of changes to previous publications. Since June in the Supreme Court's decision, have we seen more charges being filed in the context of DEI programs and people complaining about them at their organizations?
I think it's a little too soon to say. You know, we release our numbers on an annual basis, and sometimes it takes, you know, 6 months after the end of our fiscal year. So we really only just released our numbers for the last fiscal year around now. Actually, I'm not positive they're out, to be completely honest. Things go a little slower in government land.
No, come on, stop.
Right, that's a shock for everyone.
There's the big breaking news of this episode.
That's the exclusive. But, you know, certainly as a very interested observer of this space, there is absolutely rising attention in this area. There's definitely rising lawsuits. A lot of plaintiffs are choosing to pursue 1981 publicly, and they may behind the scenes be going the EEOC route or considering that. And then the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, everyone has a certain period of time in which they may be evaluating a claim. So they're, you know, the window's not kind of closed for when you might start seeing some of these claims pop up.
So there'll be, I suspect, plenty more opportunity to continue this discussion, but at least for today to wrap this up, what would be your takeaway for employers on this whole DEI issue that you want to leave them with?
So, you know, my first sort of final takeaway is this: you know, employers, you don't have any cause for concern if your diversity policies are race neutral, if your policies in general are focused on ensuring employment opportunity and expanding opportunity for all, or if you carefully consulted with counsel about the limited and narrow situations in which a voluntary affirmative action program may be implemented under Weber and Johnson and Ricci. For everyone else, there's never been a better time. I keep on saying this, but there's never a better time than to take a hard look at all how your programs are structured and evaluate the legal and practical risk posed by them. And then my final takeaway is I just encourage all employers to redouble their focus on equal employment opportunity and preventing discrimination. That's something we should all be able to get behind. There's no controversy there.
Mishne Andrea Lucas from the United States EEOC, as always, so insightful, and really appreciative of the time you give us to give us your thoughts on these important issues. So thank you so much again for coming.
My pleasure as always.
Well, that was fascinating as always, insightful as always. I appreciate the commissioner coming back onto the podcast. And as developments continue in this area, I am sure she will be back to answer some more questions. And for all of you, thank you so much as always for listening to the podcast. I appreciate it. Until the next time, I hope all of your labor is productive.